Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I'm your host, Todd Embley, and today we are delighted to speak with Clementine Pippa Ebel, a cultural strategist and expert on China's rapidly growing outdoor sports market. Clementine works for Kailas, one of China's top domestic outdoor gear brands, and brings unique insight into how Chinese consumers are embracing trail running, hiking, camping, and the broader Gorpcore lifestyle. We explore how outdoor culture is evolving across China, from elite ultramarathon events to the growth of beginner-friendly running clubs in second and third tier cities. Clementine also explains what makes Chinese outdoor consumers unique and how Western brands can enter this space authentically and the key regional nuances shaping demand. We also touch on the influence of digital communities, live streaming, and Xiaohongshu in shaping outdoor trends and why this space represents one of the most exciting opportunities in China's consumer market today. Whether you're an outdoor brand eyeing expansion into China or simply curious about cultural shifts in the region, this is a must-listen conversation for you. Enjoy.
Whilst I don't think, you know, Xi Jinping announces healthy COVID 2030 and everyone's like, right, let's get out, let's be healthy, I think what happens is that policy measure trickles down into local government policy. As always, we see that from central to local. And what that means is local then start investing in events. So events start popping up all over China and they invest in clubs. And so the infrastructure begins to appear at scale. And I think that's something that I'm really seeing in the trail and the cycling in that outdoor space, where you're getting events happening in incredibly rural areas, like very remote parts of Yunnan, because the government is like, right, we need to drive tourism. So how are we going to do that? We're going to put a race of 4,000 people here.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Clementine, and from this point forward, I will get that right and say Clementine. Welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you so much, Todd. Very, very happy to be here. And looking forward to seeing how we meander through these topics.
Well, I'm going to be meandering through the names. I have chosen to go with Clementine, and I think the reason I default to Clementine is because of that stupid song about the miner's daughter, something like this, that just rings in my head, and he says Clementine, and so I keep saying Clementine.
And it rings in my head too, Todd, it rings in mine, that's why I ditched the name.
Oh gosh. I feel awful even reminding you of that song, to be honest. Where in the world are you that we are recording you from today?
So currently in Kuala Lumpur for a brief spell, a little break from the manic life that I live in China.
And where are you usually based in China?
I live in Guangzhou.
Isn't that the home of WeChat? I know it's not the home of Tencent.
No.
Yes. But I was pretty sure that was...
I haven't seen WeChat here. I think, from my understanding, most of the tech hubs are in Shenzhen. And then kind of their second homes tend to be in Beijing, like a huge ByteDance center that's in Beijing as well. But Shenzhen is the main one with the Huawei's and some of the bigger Tencents.
Okay. I was familiar with the WeChat Weixin director of growth was a friend of mine. He was a mentor with China Accelerator. He was also one of the co-founders of Rotten Tomatoes. And he was based in Guangzhou. But again, I have to remember how long I've actually been out of China. And so my references are a decade old. It's likely not current whatsoever. Now, let's start with your personal journey. How did you end up working in China? And eventually for Kailas.
Yeah, so I moved to China back in 2017, a fresh, wide-eyed graduate from the UK, and I started by setting up my own company. Went through the delights of foreign-owned enterprises in Shanghai.
Just right out of the gate. Let's do the most hard thing right away. Why not?
Yeah, especially when you don't speak a word Mandarin. So that was a fast track way to improve your spoken Chinese. But yes, unsurprisingly and somewhat gratefully, that company failed or didn't move. I would say it didn't grow rather than failed. And so then I decided I'd actually do best to learn from Chinese companies. So I joined my first Chinese company, which was a joint venture between a British and Chinese company. And that sent me down a path which I've kind of continued to tread, which is really balancing these companies that are trying to move in both directions. They're trying to expand in China or expand in the West. And so they're forming companies on both sides at the same time. And I like kind of sitting between those. And in 2019, someone invited me to a trail race. And I had no idea what trail was, but I liked running. I liked being outside. So yeah, it sounded great. And it turns out was a closing door. A closing door moment, because I walked through that door into the world of trail and I haven't looked back. And I guess when you enter the world of trail, the most obvious place to start in China is Kailas, which is the biggest outdoor sports company and the top in trail. So it was a meandering path. And as many people who develop their careers in China, a non-linear path. But yes, I joined Kailas last year to focus on their trail segment.
Okay. So you're into running. Before trail running, what were you running? Were you hobbyist? Were you running marathons?
Yeah. So I did my first marathon at 18, but I wouldn't say it wasn't fast. So I did, 3 hours 50. I enjoyed running. And for me, it's always been to get headspace.
Yeah, the mental therapy of running. Now, when you got into trail running, have you continued into trail running? I know some of the most difficult ultramarathons, these are mostly trail now, or have been, I think, ever since. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100%. So I think, at least I associate the word ultra with trail. I don't associate it with road, because why would you do it on road? You know, it's like you're already out there long enough with a marathon, seeing concrete, counting concrete meters. I think trail is really where that growth is happening for the outdoor space, because a lot of people move from marathon into trail, and a lot of mountaineers or people who like hiking move into trail. So it's kind of bringing together these different communities, this sport.
Have you read Born to Run?
I have. Yeah. Read Born to Run, which
is one of my favorite.
Excellent. Yeah. Blends science with storytelling. It's great.
It was well done. You could tell he was a writer, thankfully, that wrote it, because I think he was a writer for Runner's World. It definitely was something that shifted my thought around my own gait, my own style, the architecture of the foot. I have some funny foot stuff, I would say, from playing a lot of hockey. So I have rather large naviculars on the instep of each of my feet. However, the doctors here refuse to do anything about it because I frankly have excellent performing feet otherwise, and they don't cause me pain unless I get up in the middle of the night and trip over a coffee table on that bone.
Unideal. Yeah.
Then it's extremely painful. No, not ideal. Now, you've been closely involved, obviously, with the scene in China. Give us some thoughts on the current state of that community and how it's evolved in recent years.
Yeah, so it has seen very clear evolution and consistent evolution, but there have been interesting spikes. So I would say the industry really got underway halfway through the 2010s, so around 2012, 2013. And you can really see that in the kind of rapid growth of events, like domestic events in that space. And there was a lot of floundering at the beginning, a lot of unprofessionalism that was very, very clear at those events and very, very clear in the participants who were not even turning up with shoes. I mean, they turn up with some shoes, but definitely not trail shoes. And so you've seen that complete transformation in 10 years of both the level of professionalism of the participants, but also the events and the kind of structure that has begun to form around that, that community. So I think an accident in 2020, which very, very tragically wiped out the top elite of China's trail runners in one sweep. I think 27 died in one race and they froze. And that was a horrific event which turned the course of that industry because, firstly, regulation crackdown was, as always, when these things happen, intense and absolute. So all events stopped for at least 2 years, nothing allowed officially. And so you would have thought that could have killed the industry. But actually what it did is it massively professionalized the industry because when people came back, only those that were adhering to standards and really kind of putting that at the forefront were going to survive. So that was a big turning point in 2020, but COVID was a big turning point because people got fit during COVID, as they did all around the world, but it's somewhat starker in China because the before and after is a much broader gap than like someone that, you know, works out a bit, works out a lot, which is what was happening in London. But in China, it was like someone that didn't even walk is now running marathons at the end of COVID. So there is that shift and it's affected all sports in China.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the entire level of activity, sports activities in general has spiked, and so has purchase rates of anything to do with healthy lifestyle in general. I think across the board, all metrics are hockey stick style. Kind of growth curves for sure. Let's talk about Kailas. Now, some of the Western listeners might not be familiar with the brand. Of course, I'm so familiar with Kailas. So this question is not for me at all, but can you give an introduction?
Yeah. So Kailas is a very interesting brand, and it kind of is a tale of modern China, modern consumerist China, and modern founder China, because the founder story is phenomenal, and I won't go into it in such detail now, but it's part of what makes the DNA of the brand so special. So it started in 2003, so it's now over 20 years old, which I love it when people in France are like, wow, I love a new brand. And I'm like, yeah, we're not new. We're only the biggest brand in the market of 1.4 billion people. So yeah, it is China's biggest outdoor brand, in terms of, I guess, size of, people working there, over 1000 employees. Yeah, it's huge. And in trail, particularly, it's dominated. But it's been really consistent, because what it has done is it's really focused on mountaineering sports. So the motto of Kailas is made to climb. And so it's centered itself around mountains, around extreme sports, and around performance right from the beginning. So I remember when I went to their office 4 years ago, and the office has moved and it's got even more like insanely kind of futuristic. But I came in, went past the gym, went past the coffee setup, and I went to the product area and they were doing 3D printing of harnesses. And I was like, okay, these guys are really serious. So innovation has been at the center of what they do. And they invest a huge amount in R&D. Now they are growing. They're really focusing on this trail segment. And they entered Europe last year with trail. And we are now setting up our first ever foreign entity opening in France, and with a pop-up store. So yeah, China speed. And I would say it is solidly a success story, of kind of new Chinese companies.
What's your role with Kailas?
So I am head of international marketing, but where I am really focusing is on partnerships with, of all kinds in Europe, but particularly in media, in the media world, in the events world, and building out a community of what will be 200 runners in Europe. So yeah, nice. Any amazing trail runners out there, get in touch and let's see if we can find you a happy home.
I might have somebody. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever knew a guy named Greg Nance.
No.
He used to live in Shanghai.
Okay.
He was quite famously a runner. He was also a startup founder. He is from the US. He was so popular, he actually was in a Seattle Seahawks, the NFL team, commercial. Wow. And he was running through Shanghai and they were filming him and the whole thing, wearing the number 12 because they call all of their fans the 12s because there's 11 players on the field. So they're the 12th player.
So good.
Yeah. And then he continued to run. He's run for charity. He ran across America raising money. And then now he is in government. I think he may have even run for like state Senate or something like this.
Oh my goodness.
Old friend, really cool guy. I'd love to put you in touch. And I'm so happy to shout out the name Greg Nance because he is one of the most phenomenal humans. And anytime that guy gets more air, it's earned. What makes Kailas such a strong brand in China's outdoor gear space? And how do they differentiate themselves from the global players who are obviously strong themselves and have a lot of tenure?
Super strong. I think the first is we have a really clear identity, and that's what I just talked about being mountain focused. But I think being an Asian brand, and I say Asian because we're very, very strong in the Southeast Asian market, and that's helped us grow.
Yeah.
We are able to prove ourselves in terrain that is incredibly technical. So if you start with 8,000 meter peaks and you prove that you can do that, you establish a reputation, which is very different from brands born out of Europe. And even if they're born out of the Alps, of course, that's very technical. But I think us starting with the Himalayas, you know, and really centering around the toughest peaks, we have developed out of that. And so our kit is durable, it's professional, it's reliable at a very different level, and it's been tried and tested for 20 years. I think that's one thing. I think the second thing, which is incredible about a Chinese company, is that we are in Guangzhou for a reason. We're an hour away from the factory, the supply chain. And that means that when we get feedback, we pass it along and we can get a new shoe in 2 days. I mean, it's not quite that fast, but you know, it's relative to a European brand. We can push out 20 shoes a year if we wanted to, whereas our competitors might push out one or two new models. So the speed of innovation and then the absolute kind of masses of people we can get testing it, I think gives a lot of credibility to the research and to the innovation.
Well, that whole Guangdong region, that is the factoring and,
absolutely,
was renowned as the factoring hub of the entire world.
Yeah.
You know, I told you a little bit about my background with the fund. And one of the reason I actually was invited to join full time was that the guy who created China Accelerator had gone to Shenzhen and started another arm of the fund investing in hardware products. And he built Hackcelerator. And the entire reason that it was based in Shenzhen was for the same reason. It was access to factories. If you're going to do anything, and this was at the rise of Arduino and Raspberry Pi, and you know, everybody started playing with hardware. Of course, Kickstarter boomed. And so that was all fine and dandy. We knew entrepreneurs could be entrepreneurs anywhere. But when you're doing hardware, when you're in the physical goods, being close to the factories, meeting the factory managers, seeing all the machines, seeing the workers, seeing things in production was so, so key. And as you know, being a founder, being an entrepreneur, that iterative cycle has to be fast. You have to run experiments, you have to learn from those experiments, and then you have to implement those learnings, and then you have to turn around and take what's new or changed or different, and then re-experiment. And the faster you can do that cycle, well, the faster you can learn, the faster you can grow and be better.
Yeah.
Or best.
Yeah, 100%. It's all about learning. Yeah, the speed of learning, the absorption of feedback, and converting that feedback into a real practical optimization.
Mm-hmm. We've all seen the loop. Well, I mean, those of us that have ever taken marketing or economics or what have you, right? That feedback loop. So the faster you can get that spinning and the tighter that you can make it, obviously, the faster that you're going to be able to go and grow. Now, you talked a lot, you know, being able to launch, was it 8,000 meters, Himalayas? There's still overcoming trust, or what I would say, overcoming mistrust. How do you deal with that? How do you battle that?
Yeah, in the European market, I assume you're talking about, consumers outside of China.
Outside Asia, yeah. Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, there is skepticism. And, you know, my favorite question is, but, you know, it's a Chinese brand. Like, how can we guarantee quality? Why would I buy from China? And I look at them in their Salomon or in their Hoka, in their Adidas, and I say, where are the clothes they're wearing from? Where do you think they come from? Do you think they're made down the road in Chamonix? Do you think they're coming out
of head to toe made in China tags? But
absolutely. So there is a lack of connection, I think, by consumers in Europe, that they're still not realizing that all of the kit they're wearing comes out of China, you know, all of this material. And you have, it is worth investigating, you know, where the cotton you're wearing comes from, where the, latex that you're buying comes from, and tracing that if you're interested. But most people are not interested. They just look at the brand and where it comes from and absorb that story. And yeah, we are all wearing things from China. And I think, you know, the outdoor market is a particularly interesting one, because Salomon, Wilson, all of these brands, Peak, they have been acquired by Anta Group under Amer. Which is, so they are now technically China owned, but of course no one knows that story. And I'm sure when that story came out, understandably those brands kept quite quiet about it. So China is already everywhere. And the fact that we are a Chinese brand, we have been trialed and tested in Asia with, you know, thousands of people buying our product. I think that speaks a lot to the credibility. But you're absolutely right. It is an obstacle. And I think it's rewriting the story around China goods and quality generally across the board. It's not just, you know, we're seeing it with cars, and I do think that's changing things. I think Huawei and I think the BYD, I think those arrivals are reframing people's mindsets around Chinese goods. But there's a long way to go with that.
Yeah. I mean, right or wrong, and it's always wrong, but, you know, me, you, our listeners, we all know the difference. We all know the right or wrong. And they could be standing there, like you said, head to toe, made in China tags sticking out. And yet their perception is still, oh, if it comes from China, it must be cheap. Or what they're telling me must not be the full truth.
Yeah.
And as somebody in charge of the narrative and the brand abroad, that must be something that you have to face and try to wrestle with and, I think, creatively attack and deal with and defend a lot, if I'm guessing right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And you have to make sure that the way that you're applying as a brand is consistent.
Yeah, I bet. Now, I think that would then just dovetail nicely into talking about the campaigns that you do run. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some interesting campaigns that Kailas has potentially organized recently.
Yeah. So I do think Kailas is doing really interesting stuff, particularly Kailas Fuga, which is the trail series that I focus on. We've done a campaign recently called Black Solitude. And Black Solitude, I love this concept because I'm a runner and I connect very closely with that concept, which is when you're running 100 kilometers, which, by the way, I haven't done yet, but I understand the mindset of it to an extent. When you start the 100K, it's usually at 9 or 10 p.m., right? So you're starting in the night. That then means you're running for quite a long time in the night. And during that time of absolute darkness, when you go into the darkest time of night, you are alone. And you're not just alone. Often with trail running, you are genuinely alone. You're physically alone because everyone's moving at their own pace and there aren't thousands and thousands of runners. There's often just a few hundred. So you're physically alone, but you're mentally and emotionally alone to kind of wrestle with your own mental state. And so the concept of black solitude plays on this idea that when you are running ultras, you go into the kind of darkest moment. But then when the light comes after maybe, you know, 8 hours of running, that is a different kind of light to the one that most people see in the day. It's the breaking of light. And so it plays on this very aesthetic idea of like night and day. But it also plays on this emotional state that makes trail runners a very different breed of humans that are excited by those states of mind that you move through and appreciate the journey of a race that is not about time. It can never be about time because there's so many unknown factors in trail running. So it plays on the emotional aspect. It plays on, what makes trail unique. And that campaign has been very successful, I think, in the aesthetics it's used. It's incredibly bold. It's incredibly dynamic and aggressive. And they have done these incredible expositions in Shanghai. So like a big, big poster falling down. And then they've used this quite gritty space, like reconstruction of space, which has vast black slabs of stone at an angle, at a very steep angle, huge kind of shoes. So it's very dynamic. It's very gritty, edgy space. They did a pop-up in Paris during Paris Fashion Week as well. Again, using this very distinctive imagery of very dark black with kind of silver, metallic colors. Yeah, and I think it is super distinctive, but it's also got depth to it as well as a concept.
Forgive me, I want to dive deeper and ask more around the why and for the whom this campaign was designed for.
Yeah. So why is because Kailas believes in storytelling.
As it should.
Yeah, as it should. But it believes in telling the stories of our runners, whether that's our athletes or our community. It's not the stories of the brand. It's listening to the individual stories and the journeys and the emotional breakdowns and the emotional recoveries that our runners go on and creating something that represents those journeys. So that's why is it's, I do genuinely think it's authentic storytelling from both our athletes, but over 95% of the entire Kailas team, we're talking hundreds of people, over 1,000 people, they have run a trail race. So the people behind the ideas of the brand, behind the product, behind even the finance team and the IT team, they are runners as well. So there is a deep authenticity in that storytelling. And who are we speaking to? I mean, we're speaking to the existing community, but we're also hoping to inspire people that have never run trail before to take to the trails and not be scared, but be excited by that journey of what trail offers.
I would think that it is not just the stories of what runners go through, but the impact, the positive change, everything that they have evolved through, going through that pain, going through that joy, that euphoria, the runner's high, the runner's low, and breaking through the black. That, and then what happens on the other side could be the key to unlocking what a lot of people have been looking for, but have been unable to find in other activities or other things. Okay. Wow. I like it when I get on my soapbox and say philosophical things like that, and there's no need to actually comment.
No, you got it all in one.
I appreciate that. What do you see are the biggest opportunities then for the outdoor brands in China? Are there particular categories like the trail running, hiking, climbing, skiing, camping?
Honestly,
rock climbing,
yeah, all of those segments are huge. I think the one that has been most visually obvious is camping, because it attracts it attracts that middle group.
I'm surprised, legitimately.
No, it's because actually, if you're going to climb a mountain, if you're going to put a harness on, you're pretty committed to an extreme sport. Like, you're not putting a harness on to walk around a city, but you can put a tent up in a city. And that's exactly what's happening. And so,
or on a beach.
This camping is happening in the parks of Guangzhou. I see hundreds every weekend. It's a delightful scene. Like, every patch of grass is covered by a camping stool and a tent. And those camping stalls also appear outside cafes in the city. So the camping market, for me, I just see how it manifests in all these peculiar places that are actually very urban. So that's why I'd say that category is very particular, because its iterations are so broad. But then hiking is huge. Yeah, hiking's really big. And interestingly, it's because I think Chinese people have actually always hiked. Like, when I look at the ayis and the shushus, the aunties and uncles doing their morning exercise, they're going straight up a hill. You know, they're going right into the mountains for the day. And so I don't think that's just a new trend. Yeah, and then back to where I am, trail. It's exploding.
You're familiar with the blue zones, I'm sure.
Tell me.
So the blue zones, it's a little tiny. Okay, so there are five areas of the world that were kind of called out as the blue zones. And it is, there are statistical anomalies of how many people there live to be 100. So the centurions. And there's been some deep dives. There's books. There's a Netflix show. There's multiple things out there. There's even a Blue Zones cookbook, of course. Why wouldn't there be? And I think you have Osaka, Japan. You have Costa Rica. You have Sicily, a place in Greece. But they identified the lifestyle. And one of the main takeaways from all of this studying of these blue zones around the world was sense of community, all this kind of stuff, but their lifestyle, how active. They laugh a lot. They can meditate a lot. They can have a lot of faith, but they live in places where they walk everywhere. And usually these places are very mountainous, very hilly. And there are people in their 80s and 90s that should probably be wearing Kailash shoes that are hiking around like monster climbs. And you know Europe. I mean, some of these places are tremendous. And I think like Osaka was a big one too. They live on the tops of mountains, and they hike down to the markets every day, and back and forth multiple times a day. And that has just been proven to be so, so good for your health. And the more that they study, I mean, even here in North America, you know, a brisk walk for an hour to where you might just get a light sweat, a slightly elevated sense of breathing, the positive effects on your health just from that daily activity can extend your life immensely. So yeah, I get it. And no place better for that to absolutely take off. But I think that it was just such a natural progression, knowing how they live there. Now we're going to get into something. I'm going to say it right now, Gorpcore. This is not the first time Gorpcore has come up. When we talked about fashion with some of our guests in fashion, this has been briefly mentioned as something. You're going to have to tell everybody. And I know I told you we have very savvy listeners, but this may be the one thing where you may actually have to explain what the heck is Gorpcore and how is outdoor fashion being received in China?
So, yeah, Gorpcore, I guess, is the meeting of outdoors, right, with functional or corporate. Right. And it's the meeting of these worlds, and it is new fashion. You see it everywhere. You see, I mean, there's a reason Solomon was at Paris Fashion Week, why Hawker's there as well. Why we're all popping up in these spaces is because these influencers and these models are wearing these really heavy, not the most attractive hiking boots around town. That's a thing. Apparently that's a thing.
Cargo pants and Doc Martens were pretty popular for quite a long time.
I mean, long gone are the days when I feel slightly embarrassed about rocking up in like some, you know, muddy hiking pants with like, you know, some little holes kind of bit through from small creatures. Mm-hmm. But
catching on a rock.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently it's now a vibe. So there we go. It's worked well for me. But yeah, it is a thing. And I think you can decide to really lean into that as a brand, as I think the Solomons of this world have done, and they are, you know, expanding out. They're expanding out into another one, athleisure. And they're, you know, trying to cut into these new segments. And you've got to make a decision with that. You've got to decide, are you core mountain, extreme sports, ruggedness, or are you going to kind of find your way on the catwalk and you know, in the nicest quarter of Paris? You've got to decide that, I think, as a brand. But there is no denying that it is a thing, and I think it's growing. Yeah.
And it's been received well in China.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you see a lot of collaborations between luxury and outdoors. And to an extent they work, but yeah, there's a question mark over their longevity, I think.
What kind of consumers are fueling the growth then in this space? Are they affluent professionals, Gen Z, parents looking for family friendly outdoor activities, clothes that you could buy for your kids that aren't just in tatters like a week later?
I wouldn't massively say the latter. I think that is an untapped space, is really for kids, to be honest. But where I would say huge growth, and I'm speaking obviously largely for trail because I actually see this, I know the stats, but I guess it's, yeah, around 30, 35 to 49. So it's the older segment. Their kids have landed. They've gone through their first phase of school maybe. And so they can roughly know what their expenditure is going to be. And they are happy to spend on themselves. They're not buying it for their kids. They're buying it for themselves. And these groups of people tend to come from good education backgrounds. They are white collar workers and they are largely from big cities. So Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, you're seeing large communities. Yeah, I'm not seeing it in the younger segment so much yet. Those early 20s, I think they're trying to find their feet in work and they're trying to get some savings. Yeah, so it's a slightly older group.
Okay, two questions based on your answer there. I'll try to separate them, but my ADHD makes me forget the second every single time. When you mentioned that they're spending on themselves, that gave rise to a thought for me of, is there a period in a person's evolution through life when they have children? And I don't know if you've looked into this at all, but when they actually go through a spell of not spending on themselves, they would be really hard to market to. Why? It's not because of who they are or how much they make or anything, but actually if you follow the breadcrumbs, it's, well, they have children that are 6 and 4. And we know that between the ages of 0 and 10, or parents who have children who are in the ages of 0 to 10, they typically spend far, far less on themselves because they're spending so much on their kids. And then after the age of 10 or something like this, that starts to resume again. Is that a thing, what I just said?
It could well be a thing in Europe. Honestly speaking, it's not what I'm seeing in China. Not in the outdoor space. And then it might be in the bigger segments. But like, for example, household goods, that's an area where consumption wise, absolutely, yeah, driving growth, and subsidies are helping that. So I don't see that trend so much in China.
The other question was price point. Where does it fall? Because Gorpcore, athleisure, I think, you know, let's talk about trail, let's talk about mountaineering. These are high quality materials,
yeah,
that are made, that are used to make these products. So there has to be, in my opinion, and I want you to corroborate this or not, these are not cheap items to own. There would be a substantial amount of, let's say, disposable income that, mm-hmm, would have to be at play for you to be able to afford these things.
For sure. They are not, they're not cheap items. But their statement pieces, you know, they tend to be pretty obvious. They're not, people aren't buying t-shirts when they're going for Gore-Tex, they're going for Gore-Tex jackets, they're going for big heavy mountain boots. So they're things that are highly visible. And I don't think you're going to stock away 10 pairs of mountain shoes. I think these are one or two big statement items that you wear.
Now, in your thoughts, or from where you sit within Kailas, what explains the uptick in outdoor sports, fitness activities, participation in China? And I know you did kind of dally into that a little bit with COVID really driving people maybe a little bit of cabin fever and needing to get out. And, well, I can't be with anybody, I got to go do something, though. Is the outdoor boom driven more by fitness, fashion, or that post-COVID lifestyle shift that we experienced? And what's your take on the cultural undercurrent?
Yeah, post-COVID lifestyle shift is a huge one. It coincides, though, with a government push for Healthy China 2030. So whilst I don't think, you know, Xi Jinping announces Healthy COVID 2030 and everyone's like, right, let's get out, let's be healthy, I think what happens is that policy measure trickles down into local government policy. As always, we see that from central to local. And what that means is local then start investing in events. So events start popping up all over China and they invest in clubs. And so the infrastructure begins to appear at scale. And I think that's something that I'm really seeing in the trail and the cycling in that outdoor space, where you're getting events happening in incredibly rural areas, like very remote parts of Yunnan, because the government is like, right, we need to drive tourism. So how are we going to do that? We're going to put a race of 4,000 people here. So I think that government initiative has really pushed the uptake across the country. But I think, that was combined with post-COVID.
Yeah, I agree. I did witness that quite a bit. I think announcements get made at the top level of what they want to focus on and what they want to do, what they want to push for. And I think everybody in China wants to be in favor with the government.
Yeah.
And if that's what they're looking for, there's an eagerness to provide that and to really take advantage of it. And there is funds, right? It can be subsidized.
Yeah.
There's a lot of green channel opportunity there to get things done swiftly. And so you see it just, it's just one of my favorite things about China. And I do love the government in so many different ways in the way that it can have such positive effects in that way. I think what people's version of communist China is so off in the detrimental way that they speak of it. There's definitely some positives, and those are good examples of those. Now let's talk about the role digital plays. How do you leverage it for building outdoor communities? And how do you leverage platforms like Xiaohongshu, Douyin to connect with trail runners and climbers?
Yeah, I mean, our Xiaohongshu is obviously very dynamic. We put a lot of pictures of our community. So yes, of course, the product is on there, but it's people participating in races as the events that we do. I would say offline remains really important. We do, of course, inhabit all digital spaces, but that's now just a given. That's now just a need. So what we do is we use the digital to enhance our offline events. We promote heavily through them. We get pre-registration. We do use those channels for that. But I would say connecting the in-store experience with an outdoor running experience, that's really what we do very well. We've had a series of female events called Alice in Wonder Trail, where basically every weekend all around China, we're doing little pop-up events. We invite the members, Kailas members, to come, all of the women, and listen to a share from a pro athlete. And then they go on a trail run together. Simple format, very replicable. And yeah, it's been going on for months. So that's, we do combine both digital and offline.
I love that. I mean, and I was going to ask you a little bit of something like that next. I mean, just talking about, or having you tell us a little bit about those standout events, races, communities in the trail running world that brands really should know about.
There are some incredible events in the trail space, and I am now responsible for getting media out to China, because I think there's really a willingness there, but they don't know where to start with it. because China is this big black hole, which seemingly, you know, am I allowed a visa? Am I not allowed a visa? Do I need a visa? Are there flights? Like, there are lots of uncertainties that, yeah, in answer to all of those, yes, you can come. And we can help you if there needs to be, but you can also do it yourself. So there are lots of events that are really worth doing and very few people know about. So Chongli, which is an amazing part of China, just north of Beijing, hosts many races. And that's probably one of the biggest ones in China, 618. So that's, just happened actually not 618. That's the festival. It's in July.
That's the big shopping bonanza. Yeah,
that would be a June car 18th. Crash if they put it on the same day. Actually, no one would show up. Or it'd be, swiping or scrolling on from the mountain.
Yeah, trail running and shopping.
Terrible.
The most distance with the most things purchased.
Yeah, exactly. Chongli is good. My favorite one is Four Sisters, which is a high altitude race. It can start at 4,000. Some of these races. And absolutely epic. So China is doing its own thing in the event space, and international runners are beginning to come, but very, very small numbers.
All right, last question. If you could give a piece of advice to a Western outdoor brand looking to enter China today, what would it be?
I think it returns to that thing that I just mentioned of combine offline with online and really engage with those communities, engage with those races. There are so many happening and they're very open to international brand sponsorship. So get involved. Kailas, we do it overseas and it works wonders for us by sponsoring trail events. But, you know, the North Face has sponsored brands, Mammoth has sponsored events, and that gets visibility. So I think utilizing those offline in-person channels, working with local teams, super important, and people are really up for it, really open to it in China.
Clementine, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Todd. And yeah, any of your listeners, feel free to reach out and try out a pair of Kailas shoes. See where it takes you.
Literally, see where it takes you. I love that. Okay, for everybody listening to the podcast, don't forget about the YouTube channel over at WPIC. For those watching on YouTube, don't forget we have the audio version only on all your favorite podcast platforms. Don't forget to like and subscribe. We really appreciate your support. But for me, from everybody at the negotiation team, and for Clementine Pippa Ebel from Kailas, thank you very, very much for listening and or watching. And we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.